Morning, everybody. On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Happy Labor Day, and welcome to Maryland Morning. So here's a cheery thought to kick off your holiday. The first two leading causes of death in the United States are heart disease and cancer. The third leading cause, medical errors. Researchers at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine found that mistakes in prescribing drugs, miscues in surgery, and miscommunication between caregivers leads to an astonishing number of preventable deaths every year. Dr. Michael Daniel explains how the medical community is addressing this endemic problem. Then, 53 years after Martin Luther King led the March on Washington, a conversation with civil rights activist and icon Gloria Richardson, one of the founders of the Cambridge Movement on Maryland's Eastern Shore. And local author Kathy Flan on her latest collection of Baltimore-based short stories, Get a Grip. We'll get to work on this special Labor Day edition of Maryland Morning right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1 WIPR, it's Maryland Morning. Thanks for spending part of your Labor Day holiday with us. We will begin today with a look back at a story that we aired last May about some frankly scary data that had just been compiled by researchers at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. For some time, it's been known that heart disease and cancer are the leading causes of death in the United States. Sometimes patients develop those diseases because of certain behaviors like smoking, but often they get sick through no fault of their own. They're just subject to a lousy luck of the draw. But the third leading cause of death in the United States is almost completely preventable. Medical errors in hospitals and healthcare facilities are right behind heart disease and cancer on the list of killers. More people die of preventable mistakes than die of other notorious causes like respiratory disease and stroke. Researchers analyzed 8 years of data and found that things like misdiagnosis and prescription mix-ups account for 250,000 deaths every year. This is frightening, but the doctors behind the research hope that their discovery will lead to breakthroughs in the way that hospitals track and approach medical errors. I was joined in the studio last May by Dr. Michael Daniel. He's a research fellow and co-author of the study about medical errors, along with Dr. Martin A. McCary. It was published in the British medical journal BMJ. Dr. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And I understand you've been a doctor for about a week, huh?
That's right.
You graduated from Hopkins Med School just last week?
I did, on Monday.
Well, congratulations, and your intention is to have a residency continue at Hopkins.
That's right. I'm doing internal medicine on the Osler Residency Program at Johns Hopkins Hospital.
Terrific. Well, congratulations, and glad you're staying in town. So let's talk about the kind of medical errors that you studied in this hospital. When we say medical errors, what does that mean?
So a medical error can be any number of things, but usually it's a variation from standard basics of care. So essentially, for example, we have communication breakdowns where a physician is transferring a patient to another physician and information gets lost. And then from that, elements of the patient's care is missed. Other errors include just missing information. They include diagnostic errors. They include faulty equipment, things of that nature. And all of these we found add up to potentially about 250,000 deaths per year in the United States hospital. Now, this was using the 2013 hospital admissions in order to create this data. And essentially, this was scary because before this, we didn't realize exactly how many deaths occurred. And the most commonly cited figures for this were about 44,000 to 98,000, but this data came from about 1984 and 1992, and so that was so long ago, and we just really wanted to update this science and then hopefully from there, allow us to move forward and to start putting in procedures to fix this.
So miscommunication can be a problem, sometimes misdiagnoses.
Correct.
And now, that's what we might refer to, I suppose, as an honest mistake. I mean, a doctor sees a set of symptoms and says, well, I think it's this, and then it turns out to be that. There are obviously mistakes during surgery. We, have heard about those. Is there one cause of those, that list of three or four things, that is the very much predominant cause of when we talk about medical errors?
Yeah, so some of the major causes include dosing and medication errors, as well as the communication errors. Those what we found were what we found to be the most common, and also some of the most harmful.
So, like a doctor, you know, she intends to prescribe 10 cc's of something for somebody, and she ends up writing 100.
Correct.
Yeah, exactly. And then you've got problems. Yes. And drug interactions. Sometimes they don't always take in account what one drug will do in conjunction with another drug.
That is correct. Yeah.
How is the when we take this issue of communication breakdown?
Yeah,
are there protocols then that can be put into place so that those things don't happen? Checks and balances and double checks. I mean, I know Dr. Peter Pronovost, who's been on the show, has talked about a checklist of things that you should, you know, every physician should go down to make sure that just nothing slips through the cracks.
Right. Well, so that's exactly right. And that's what we want. So, you know, Dr. Pronovost, for example, has done a lot of work in hospital-acquired infections and in eliminating those by using a checklist. But for medical errors, because this data hasn't been formally looked at and hasn't been part of the conversation for most of, you know, medical care, there isn't those types of procedures in place. I know that at the Armstrong Institute at Johns Hopkins, they're working on putting this type of work together. But for the most part, it's overlooked. And because it's been overlooked, there aren't as much.
And the Armstrong Institute at Hopkins is a particular thing that they set up specifically to look at the issue of medical errors. And other hospitals, University of Maryland and hospitals around the country have similar organizations. So they're you know, the board of directors, as I understand it from Peter Pronovost, you know, they actually talk about medical mistakes in their board meetings. I mean, right. So this is something that they're trying to keep high on the list of priorities.
But the issue that we're trying to address is that there's a lot of variation in this. So there are a number of hospitals that do, but then there are hospitals that don't. And when these errors occur in, let's say, the hospitals that don't, and even in our hospital, it's a private conversation. It isn't a conversation that's held at a national level. It isn't a conversation that's held so that, you know, everyone is made a member. And because of that, we're not learning from these mistakes in a comprehensive manner. And so that's what we were truly trying to get out there, is trying to encourage both the CDC as well as other people in the hospital to look into this information, to be aware of it, and then from that to really start to put in procedures to help.
Dr. Michael Daniel is the co-author of a Johns Hopkins study that found that medical errors are the third leading cause of death in the United States. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Let's talk about the CDC, because they don't necessarily buy into the research that you've done. If you look at the CDC website, they would say that the first leading cause of death is heart disease, the second is cancer, and the third is respiratory disease, the fourth is accidents, etc. They haven't quite accepted this, and part of it has to do with the way people report deaths. If you're a physician and someone dies, there's a code you have to put on the death certificate. And I guess there isn't a code that encompasses medical error.
No, that's exactly right. So the code that you're talking about is the International Classification for Disease. So this code was created so that we could compare certain diseases with other countries as well as our own and collect statistics based on gender, ethnicity, race, things like that. Unfortunately, when this code was created, they didn't think about, or at least it wasn't put high on the priority, the issues of medical error and human errors and behavioral errors. And these can cause a lot of damage. So, for example, the code that you could have an overdose, or you could have someone who takes anticoagulation that causes them to, you know, unfortunately expire. And that code is in separate places. It doesn't come together for statistics as well as other behavioral and human factors. And because of this, we're missing that data. And so what we had to use in order to collect our numbers is use the most recent studies. And those, while these are great, these are not the type of census-like tabulation of statistics that you get with the national statistics that the CDC accumulates. So what we wanted was, we were hoping that using the death certificates, is how the CDC currently codes this information, we could add a section that says, did a medical error occur? And by doing that, that would allow for more census-type tabulation, which would give us more accurate numbers, and we'd be able to break it down based on other factors, including location, regions, gender, race, ethnicity, things like that.
CDC says that if you change things now, it makes it difficult to compare American statistics with statistics around the world, that it would no longer be apples and apples, it would be apples and oranges, because the international guidelines might be a little different. What do you think about that?
Well, so what we're asking is not to change the ICD system. I believe the ICD system has been in place for years, since the 1940s, and it does work for that comparison. But what we're looking at is more of just a section that allows for physicians to say something that we did caused this problem. And so this would be, in the beginning, would at least be useful in the United States so that we could tabulate our information. And then, if it works and we're realizing that we're getting a lot of data and we're missing a lot of medical errors, then it can be brought to a national level. And I do know that the death certificate is updated every 13 to 15 years. And I believe the last one was in the early 2000s. So we're getting to a place.
It's about time.
It's about time to think about it.
Effect of this, I mean, obviously, people think about medical errors, they think about litigation.
Yes.
This is a very litigious society. Obviously, if you put medical error on the death certificate, that's what the lawyer waves in court. Right. I mean, that plays into this a lot, doesn't it?
It does. And, it's a tough thing. Essentially, if the data that we have is right, and 250,000 people are losing their lives early due to medical error, then I think that we have to think about, well, what's more important to us? Is it more important that we, put in procedures and we put in practice things that are going to save these people? Or is it more important that we try to protect against, the litigious society that we live in? And the other thing is, it doesn't necessarily have to be straight about the litigious side. It also could be, we could try to find ways of making this so that the hospitals and that the medical community can really learn from it without broadcasting the fact that, something may have happened. And a medical error doesn't always have to be that the physician is liable, but a medical error, medical malpractice is a little bit different than medical errors. And so, it may also be that we are just putting it down in a way that allows us to tally, but then also if something does happen, then we can investigate it further for the malpractice side. But I think the tally is more important because that's what's going to help us save lives.
Indeed. Well, Dr. Daniel, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in, and I appreciate your telling us about the study.
Yeah, no problem.
Dr. Michael Daniel is the co-author of a Johns Hopkins study that found that medical errors are the third leading cause of death in the United States. We spoke here on Maryland Morning last May. For more information about the study, come to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, a conversation with Gloria Richardson, one of the pioneering and largely unsung women who helped lead the 1960s civil rights movement here in Maryland. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Last week, we shared a conversation I had with the Baltimore civil rights pioneer Helena Hicks, whose participation in a 1955 sit-in helped to desegregate the Reed's drugstore chain. This morning, the story of another largely unsung civil rights pioneer. I spoke with her last January. Her name is Gloria Richardson. She was born in 1922, and she was active in the early years of the civil rights movement, a time when men largely overshadowed the women who were playing pivotal roles as activists and organizers. Now living in New York City, Gloria Richardson was front and center of the fight for equal rights on Maryland's Eastern Shore in the 1960s, where she helped organize the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee, which later came to be known as the Cambridge Movement.
I was born in Baltimore, actually, and we lived there till I was about 8 or 9 years old. The Depression came along, and my father closed his drugstore in Baltimore, and the family, our household, moved down to Cambridge. He reopened a drugstore there. We went and lived with my mother's parents. I grew up in a segregated school system. I also was in kind of a bubble because Cambridge, that part of Eastern Shore, was kind of fortunate. There were no lynchings, although they were in other towns. Jim Crow kinds of things were, if you knew your place in that society, it was very even. I knew not to go into the I don't know how I knew that, but I knew where I wasn't supposed to go. My grandfather had a grocery store and was an undertaker and city councilman. I almost forgot that. And so I think it was two kinds of bubbles, the whole second ward, because Cambridge was divided into wards, one black ward, four white wards. So we were, in terms of churches and stores and things, almost a whole separate little city. They respected and were heavily involved in the stories of both Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman. I think you grew up knowing they were alternatives, whether they presented themselves in Cambridge or not. I think Frederick Douglass's plantation was about 10 minutes' ride from Cambridge. And Harriet Tubman, I think they have it a little wrong now, but everybody in Cambridge even today knows what other little town she was from. So we kind of grew up with that history. And that may, now that we're talking about it, have also been, you know, internally part of that background of why Cambridge blew up so much.
In the early 1960s, activists from groups like CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, worked to desegregate restaurants along Route 40. It was called the Route 40 Project. Route 40 was the primary route between Washington, D.C. and New York. Nearly all of the restaurants and facilities on that road were only open to whites. Those sit-ins from Baltimore to Wilmington, Delaware, led to the creation of the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee.
Initially, it was for public accommodations, but they had been going doing the Route 40 demonstrations, CORE, the Student Nonviolent Action Committee, and I guess the NAACP, in that Baltimore, Washington area. And because they were after Governor Taws, who was governor at that time, and he lived down on the eastern shore of Maryland, they rented buses and were going down the eastern shore. My family got involved because my uncle was a bail bondsman, and they did some demonstrations up and down the eastern shore until Crisfield, Maryland. And on the way back, they had been arrested and whatever, but on going back to Baltimore, my cousin said to them, you know, it's totally segregated in Cambridge. Why don't you all stop off there? And the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee sent two field secretaries. And they began to have rallies and meetings. And surprisingly, in the black community, just hundreds of people went out. They had them in the churches. And out of that came the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee. And because my daughter was involved in the sit-ins, then I got involved. And it was the first adult because the high school and grammar school kids had almost shut down the town. And then the black preachers decided that they would have quiet and peace and then negotiate whatever it was they wanted for the stores to open up. You know, 1 week passed, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, till finally the kids were just totally demoralized. And because the parents had backed them in the beginning, we went down to Atlanta to ask Nick if, even though we were adults, you know, could we form a chapter.
When Richardson organized the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee, it was the first adult group affiliated with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. At that point, she was in her late 30s. I asked her about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's authorizing her to form the first adult organization affiliated with SNCC.
When the high school and grammar school kids were out on the public accommodations and their parents in the community supported them, there used to be a group of adults that met. I think it was the first time white folks knew that some of the black folks owned their homes because they were also putting up bail and stuff from their property and whatever. I guess it's that thing about the white gaze doesn't see you. Because certainly it was registered downtown. You know, it wasn't a big secret. So they were 9 or 10 people. And then there were other people that had small businesses. And they used to go to meetings at my uncle's house. So the adult CNAC grew out of that.
I asked her what sort of actions the groups did.
We were having mass rallies and picketing, and also the young people were involved. But at one point, I decided that there were greater issues, or felt that there were greater issues than just the public accommodations. So I set up a survey and the kids distributed it. And we found out that actually public accommodations was the last on a list of about five. It was better housing, school desegregation, ability to go to the hospital. So they were like four or five other things. And of course, jobs. That's what we presented to the city council then, were those five issues, and to work on them. And that's what started the general movement.
And in 1963, after a couple of years of these actions and protests, there was violence in Cambridge.
Oh, yes. It was consistent violence every night. When we were doing demonstrations and picketing and marchings, we did that legally, according to law, although there were some arrests. But then at night, when the white gangs would come out and shoot and set off Molotov cocktails, the men in the second ward that were black, you know, responded to that. So it was almost like two movements going on. Eventually, the governor had to send in the National Guard to keep calm while the negotiations were going on.
And were the precepts of this organization based on Dr. King's work in nonviolent protest?
No. I mean, we didn't work within the frame of Martin. In the first place, he was young. Nobody knew much about him. He was just another civil rights worker. And I don't really think the black people or the black men in Cambridge would have sat there and let them, you know, destroy wherever they lived and things like that, or beat them up or shoot at them.
There was a lot of violence during the years of the Cambridge movement.
Oh, yes.
61, 62, up through 63.
Up through 63. Because even with the treaty that we, quote unquote, that we signed, one of the whereases in there was that if things went according to the agreement, that we would suspend demonstrations for an indefinite time.
And it ended in what's known as the Treaty of Cambridge, and some real serious changes did take place following those protests.
Yes. The agreement was signed off on by Robert Kennedy and Burke Marshall. It included some of the history that had gone on in those last two or three years, and also the total desegregation of schools that the city council and the city fathers would agree to apply to the National Housing Authority to put in 200 units of housing, which they did, and some side things that went on. They couldn't come out now, ward, and destroy property and put something up. It was an urban renewal program nationally, but in the case of our agreement, it had to stop at the beginning of the second ward. So that enabled them to put money into doing some kinds of building in the other wards, and they would have to hire blacks because it was federal money.
What do you remember the most about segregated life in Cambridge that you encountered as a young person and then when you returned to take care of your relatives as a young mother yourself?
I don't think I paid too much attention to it because I was living in an entirely black world. Wherever we went visiting friends, you know, Baltimore, Washington, New York, most of them, I guess, were professionals, except to know that you were being discriminated against. I don't think, it wasn't something I worried about every day. If everything was going okay, that may have been because I didn't have to worry financially. But I had always been brought up to know that I had to remember that I was able to live well because the clients and the customers that my family had in whatever they were doing, that also the lawyer and a doctor. I was kind of raised to look down on so-called middle-class blacks and leap over them into, you know, those people that if they were spending your money here, their money here, you know, you wouldn't be able to do this and that.
I want to move now to the March on Washington. When you were on the stage with Dr. King, what was your planned role?
I don't think they did not want me there. I had about a 2 weeks leeway before they invited me. I wasn't really interested because I really thought people should lay down in the streets of Washington and just stop it. But in any event, I went. They picked me up late. I was late getting on the stage, and when I got there, they had removed my chair with the banner. and Lena Horne and Josephine Baker were sitting on the left side where they were taking me, and they said to me, they moved your chair, you should raise hell. So I said, no, I don't need any of this, because we were in the midst of getting ready to sign that the first agreement anyhow. And so I went in the back of the group, because there was a lawyer back there that I wanted to talk to about some of the problems in Cambridge. So that's what I did. They announced the name, and everybody around me said, no, go up there. So I went up there, and when I got the microphone, I said, hello. And when I was waiting for the applause to die down, they took the mic away from me, because I was going to say, sit there. Don't move from here for the next day till they pass the civil rights bill, which really wasn't that adequate anyhow. But that's what had, that was the scene.
This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, my country, tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
In 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a very different figure than the person he's grown to be in the light of history.
Actually, Martin was just like, I guess, any young man. He did not have the kind of fame that he has now. And I guess that's because he was less controversial. I know when we really pushed the economic stuff, he sent one of his key people to see if I would meet with him and explain to him about the economic goals that we were pushing. Because initially, when SNCC left the first time back in the public accommodation days, people wanted him to come to Cambridge to speak. And when they invited him, he said no. He was booked for at least 2 years. And that we would have to pay him $3,000. Well, we were a little tiny, 2,000 or 3,000 people. We were not going to be able to have any $3,000 to give him. And actually, that was a good thing for us, because then we had to do it ourselves. And so that's when people started, and older people started activating and doing things and pushing things and coming to the meetings.
When you see the unrest that unfolded in Baltimore in response to the death of Freddie Gray while he was in police custody in April of 2015, what was your initial reaction?
Oh, I was glad. Baltimore had been so suppressed for so long. People had been running around saying, if you don't vote, you can't get freedom. Well, that's a lie, too. I think Black Lives Matter is just tremendous. I was invited to be on a panel with Ms. Hamer and Ms. Parks. They had this convening up at Columbia University. And it was just great. They were young, young people, not teenagers, but young people up there. And I just thought what they have done so far is great. I mean, this is the second time around, so what do people expect?
And what do you think the priorities of the Black Lives Matter movement should be? Do you think that they are?
Well, I think it's so varied because you have people across the country where some of it is, it was the actual Black Lives Matter thing, but they're into pretty much everything except voting, which I hope they don't get into. The school, which I didn't realize that it was still bad in Ivy League schools till you had this, till you had the four or five schools where students were demonstrating against. I don't even know if their parents knew it.
Sure, Yale University and so on.
But I mean,
other,
they seem to be, you know, anything that's discriminatory or racist.
You've mentioned voting a couple of times. You said that you hope the Black Lives Matter movement doesn't get involved in voting. Why not?
Oh, yeah, no, because I don't think they make... Look at Baltimore. All the government was black. Yet the white folks in the other wards didn't even know the National Guard had been there. And what was that, 2 or 3 days of just looked like pure hell.
Gloria Richardson, one of the organizers of the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee on the Eastern Shore in the 1960s, part of what came to be known as the Cambridge Movement. She spoke to me last January from her home in New York City. We've got more information on our website, including an iconic image of Gloria Richardson pushing a bayonet away from a protesting crowd. That's at WIPR.org/Marilyn Morning. Coming up, we revisit a conversation with Baltimore author Kathy Flan about her latest collection of short stories called Get a Grip. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Everything gonna be all right one day. Everything gonna be all right one day. Everything gonna be all right. Lord, one day. Yeah, Lord. You've been.
Oh. Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Kathy Flan is a writer who teaches fiction and creative nonfiction at Goucher College in Towson. She recently published an absolutely terrific book of short stories, most of which are placed in and around Baltimore, and all of which are peopled with richly textured and fascinating characters, from 7-foot-tall Estonian brothers hoping to get admitted to Loyola College, to an inspiring writer trying to keep her deadbeat dad at bay, to a guy who finds a meteor in Catonsville. This book is called Get a Grip, and this past January, Kathy Flan joined me in the studio, and we talked about it. It's great to meet you.
Oh, thanks. It's great to meet you. Good morning.
And I'm just a huge fan of this book. Congratulations on it. I really, really enjoyed it. Our mutual friend Madison Smart Bell turned me on to it, and I'm really glad that he did. The title's Get a Grip. That's also the title of a story. I guess all of these stories are in some way about how folks are figuring out how to get a grip.
Yes, exactly. It was... a real labor of love. I moved to Baltimore in 2008, so I'm coming to it with an outsider's perspective, having lived in a lot of different, you know, small towns and smallish cities here and in England. And I've came here and having moved a lot as a single person and starting over a lot of times, Baltimore was by far the easiest place to make friends, the place I felt most engaged with right away in terms of a community. And it's kind of got the tight-knit quality of a small town and yet the sort of challenges and benefits of an urban center.
So you came to Baltimore to take the gig at Goucher College?
I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I just really found it a really important community to me right away.
But there's also, as you read through these stories, there's a very fungible meaning to the notion of get a grip. I mean, that's a little, you know, colloquialism that we all use, but, you know, it means different things to different characters, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And I think, you know, the characters, I hope, are you know, quite different from each other. And each story wasn't written necessarily thinking about the collection as a whole. But once it was coming together as a book, and which story was going to be the title story, it just seemed right that it should be that particular story.
Yeah, and the title story concerns a woman, I guess 40-ish, something like that, who's dating a younger man.
Yes.
And sort of trying to negotiate her feelings that she has for this guy. So she's trying to get a grip in a particular way. Tell us a little bit about her and him.
The story begins, it's the day of her 40th birthday, and she's kind of struggling with that. And, you know, in the midst of a kind of existential moment of reflection on where she is, which isn't very satisfying to her, her ex walks in and, you know, she kind of pounces on him at that moment. Mm-hmm. I think it's a story in a lot of ways about the ways that we can kind of trick ourselves.
One of the things that struck me is that there's two things about this. It's a very sexy book. There's a lot of sex in it. There's a lot of amorous love and physical love and interesting takes on the notion. It's not, prurient by any means, but it's sexy. And all of the women in this book are beautiful and alluring and attractive in every way. I mean, do you ever write about unattractive people? Am I ever going to end up in one of your books?
I think that, I don't know. I feel like no matter who someone is, they have beauty, And I think that, I guess that's what I'm seeing through the physical. I think that we all have so many flaws, and I try to address that as well. But I think that, we all have beauty, and I guess I kind of see life that way, that it's beautiful and absurd and tragic, and I hope that each person in the collection reflects all of those things.
And two of the most beautiful characters, who are also among the most absurd and tragic in a lot of ways, are these two Estonian brothers. They're basketball players. They're giants. And they're here in Baltimore with their mother. And all of a sudden, because of their basketball prowess, they have the opportunity, perhaps, to go to Loyola College. But this is not any simple admissions story, is it?
No. They're trying to do something which seems simple, which is just get across town from their neighborhood to Loyola so they can do an interview. But there's many obstacles. The bus doesn't come. I think anybody who's lived here for a while and uses the bus could tell a story about a time when the bus didn't come or something happened. And so even after being here a short time, I knew that happened a lot to people. So that was part of the story. The bus doesn't come. What will they do then? With them being as tall as they are, with them being mixed race, they face this challenge. Like, no, they can't get anyone to stop for them. They can't get anyone to kind of give them a break to get across town to just a few miles just to get to the interview. So, the idea of being a kind of stranger in your own in your own land,
I'm not going to give anything away, but they do make it to the campus. And then when they make it, there's another very interesting twist and turn. Almost every story has a very interesting, unexpected twist and turn. Do you consciously balance this tension between storyline and plot and what's going to happen to the people with the sort of literary descriptions of what's going on in their heads?
Yeah, I always try to think about what the desire of the character. What does the character want more than anything in the world right now? What does this character want? And what stands in the way of getting it at this particular moment? And what would be the worst thing for this particular character at this moment in this story? And what will they do in response to that?
Do you plot this all out before you start writing?
Do you have a little
Are you one of those graphers who says, she goes here, she meets him.
No index cards. Uh-huh. No. I write the beginning. I write until I hit that roadblock where I'm like, I don't know what else should happen. And maybe that's page 6. And when I realize, I don't know what's going to happen, I often go back and write it again. I write the beginning again. And I think, well, there was something I didn't know that didn't allow me to figure out what the character would do. And if I don't know what the character would do, it's because I didn't know the character well enough. I didn't know what was the worst thing that could happen to them at that moment because I didn't know them well enough. So I go back to the beginning.
And beginnings have different endings, of course.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. What are you looking for in a reader? Who's your ideal reader?
Oh, gosh. That's That's a really hard question. I feel like a reader with a sense of humor is important to me. And I hope whenever anyone says something like, oh, I thought this story was so funny, I always find that the biggest compliment, because I am dealing with difficult issues and material. But I do think life is funny. And I always want that to come through the characters rather than from me. So I don't ever know if like that's going to resonate or hit people the right way. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of my favorite thing is when that happens.
This is your second collection of short stories. We're just finishing up here, just a few seconds left. How do you figure out whether a story is novel size or short story size?
Well, I guess I always tended to gravitate to the short story because I feel like there's this opportunity for little to stand for big. And I feel like life is like that, that there's these little things that happen, and they indicate so much.
Well, this is a book of little things with big impact. So congratulations. It's really terrific.
Oh, thank you so much.
Great
Thanks
to
for
meet
having
you.
Me.
Kathy Flann speaking with me earlier this year. She teaches fiction and creative nonfiction at Goucher College in Towson. Her latest collection of short stories is called Get a Grip. It was published last fall by Texas Review Press, and we've got a link to information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That wraps it up for us this morning. We'll be back Wednesday. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great holiday.
From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there.